Members, please take your seats. Turn off or silence all cell phones or electronic devices. Children, Families, and Senior Subcommittee will now come to order. Jude Lean, please call roll and announce quorum.
Chair Coster.
Here.
Representatives Basabi.
Here.
Bearfield. Black.
Here.
Barrero.
Here.
Gossett Seidman.
Here.
Harris.
Here.
Joseph. Killebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
Lopez. Maney.
Here.
Michael.
Here.
Rayner. Roach.
Present.
Robinson. Tremont.
Here.
Williams.
Here.
And Woodson.
Here.
A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Jude Lean. Welcome, members. Today's meeting, we're going to hear presentations on human trafficking, an important topic on which our legislature has done significant work over the years, including last year, where our subcommittee heard legislation on regulation of safe homes. As always, we will, at the end of each presentation, have time for members' questions. So if you can just keep your questions to the end of the presentation, you can, you know, wave, flag me down and I'll get your name on the list. But rather than interrupting our presentation, we'll just continue and do questions at the end. We're going to begin today's overview of human trafficking with Terry Coonan, who's an internationally recognized expert on the issue. He's the executive director of Florida State University Center for the Advancement of Human Rights and associate professor of criminology at Florida State University. Welcome, Mr. Coonan. You're recognized to the podium.
The opportunity to talk to you about one of the great human rights issues that we have here in Florida and nationwide. A great deal of the work that our Human Rights Center at Florida State University does is victim care. We've worked with several hundred victims of human trafficking in the last 20 years. That's both sex trafficking and labor trafficking, both children and adults, both U.S. citizens and foreign nationals. We have a host of different victims. Florida is also fortunate. We have one of the best state responses to human trafficking. This legislature is primarily responsible for that. Thank you for the legislation that you have almost done annually for us in the anti-trafficking movement, including last year that will continue this year, looking at adult safe homes, essentially licensing them, and will be the first state in the country to do so. A lot of the work that I do is working with prosecutors, law enforcement, and also service providers in terms of training, in terms of what do victims tell us, what do survivors tell us. So that's a great deal of what I'll give you today, kind of a quick overview on human trafficking. When we talk about human trafficking, we're talking about two different kinds of trafficking. U.S. and Florida law talk about sex trafficking, which is forced prostitution, and also labor trafficking, forced labor of any other kind. Trafficking can involve crossing a U.S. border, oftentimes undocumented, many times with a legal visa. But crossing a border and actually movement is not at all required. That is ultimately a crime against a person. And in Florida here, we're seeing children being trafficked, never having left their neighborhoods, never having at times left the block that they live on. So it's a crime against a person, not to be confused with especially smuggling or transporting crimes. What we'll also see is that the way that Florida and the federal laws define trafficking, it's the use of force, fraud, which is fraudulent promises, or coercion to basically control a victim. The coercion is especially important. That actually means psychological coercion. We talk about trafficking as modern slavery, but it doesn't involve necessarily people with guns held to their heads, people that are in chains, chained to a bed. No, coercion, the invisible chains of human trafficking, are what we most often see here in Florida. How is it that victims are held and exploited? So force, fraud, or coercion are, in fact, legal terms of art, both in our Florida statutes and in our federal statutes as well. Again, physical force no longer required. Federal law back in 2000 changed the game entirely. used to be that you had to show for any kind of slavery conviction physical force or a threat of it. Back in 2000, that changed. We actually recognized that a lot of the modern slavery cases that we have did not involve a gun held to somebody's head. It didn't involve necessarily physical force. So both federal law and Florida law now recognize coercion, psychological coercion, as really the prime way that many of our victims are now exploited. We talk about that as the invisible chains of human trafficking. As a result, prosecutors, both in our state courts but also in our federal courts, have brand new tools to now get convictions. They no longer have to show this person, again, had a physical, they were physically forced into doing something. We now understand that relationships can be exploited, drug addictions can be exploited, any number of things can actually be exploited to make someone into a trafficking victim. This is a map of where do we see the most human trafficking cases here in the country? Florida is, again, if you look at it, we're a big red spot. It turns out we're number three in the country for reported cases. We've had both the largest sex and labor trafficking cases occur here in Florida. If you looked at this, you would also see the U.S. highway system. You could actually see I-95, the I-95 corridor that goes right up and down the East Coast. You can see the I-75 corridor starts in, again, Central Florida, goes all the way up through, again, Atlanta on up into Tennessee. You could also see the I-5 corridor. Growing up in California, we called the San Diego Freeway, again, on the West Coast. Movement is not required for trafficking, but our traffickers utilize our highways routinely for both sex trafficking and labor trafficking, moving victims. One of the challenges, trafficking moves from court or from state to state. It moves from county to county. It moves from judicial circuit to judicial circuit. One of the great things we have in Florida is our Office of the Attorney General, Office of the Statewide Prosecutor, has been given jurisdiction for these cases that will move beyond a single judicial circuit, one of the great tools that Florida has. But it is a national problem. Actually, every state in the country has now had trafficking cases. We were among the first to report them. And to be honest, we have been one of the best states to respond to this as well. Here's our Florida heat map. Again, we have this statewide. We actually have what we call, especially the corridor, the gold corridor down there from Miami up to West Palm Beach. We've had a slew of both sex and labor trafficking cases, but also looking at other areas, you can actually see, if you looked west there, you'd see Naples, but also Palatka. We have actually had some of the largest labor trafficking cases right here in Palatka, Florida. In Immokalee, Palatka up north, but in Immokalee, where we have actually had dozens of labor trafficking cases. You see Orlando, you see Tampa. If this map were to be updated, it would also show North Florida as red spots as well. We'll look at a few of the cases that we have seen to give you an idea about that. But it is a statewide issue. It's not confined just to particular cities or particular regions. Sex trafficking, very importantly, is defined as the use of force, fraud, or psychological coercion to induce an adult, again, someone 18 years or older, to engage in commercial sex. What we now understand, though, the largest pool of sex trafficking victims that we have are minors, both here in Florida and nationwide. There's a separate definition. If a minor is simply found to be engaged in commercial sex, they're a sex trafficking victim. They don't have to prove up force, fraud, or coercion. And we have great state prosecutors statewide that have actually taken these cases and have done quite remarkable work in recent years. We've also got new law, thank you, that you passed last year that limits the kinds of depositions of child sex trafficking victims as well. The trauma that they suffer, they're often re-traumatized in depositions or on the witness stand. So some very, very good law that all of you gave us last year that limits that. But again, we treat children differently. DCF is doing leading work, working with child trafficking victims, sex trafficking primarily, but also labor trafficking here in our state. Florida has very good law on what we call coercion for prostitution. We're actually a leading state when it comes to how we have recognized that people can be forced, can be actually coerced into prostitution. Again, not with guns held to people's heads, not that they're beaten. Blackmail is often the source of that. Also, threats to interfere with parental rights, exploiting developmental disabilities. We actually see quite a few of our younger victims who have a developmental disability, cases that used to refer to them as mentally retarded. We wouldn't use that term now, but we're seeing that as a prime vulnerability for a lot of the victims in our cases here in Florida. Also, exploiting pornographic performance. A lot of our children are drawn into sex trafficking through sexting. They're invited into a relationship in which they're invited to share pornographic pictures over their cell phone, and they're then blackmailed. They're then blackmailed into taking part in prostitution. So exploiting that kind of pornographic performance is something that we've seen cases on here in Florida. And finally, very importantly, our law recognizes exploiting human needs for food, shelter, safety, or affection. The kinds of ways that people can be manipulated into prostitution. This is some of the best law in the country, by the way. I have legislatures from around the country contacting me, wanting to kind of duplicate much of what we do in Florida, but especially looking at this particular part of our statutes. A few of the recent trends. One of the things our Human Rights Center does, we convene prosecutors and law enforcement and service providers several times a year from all over Florida. They're basically making up what we call anti-trafficking task forces or coalitions. Every judicial circuit has one. We bring them together to talk about what do we continue to learn, that this crime changes annually. Our law enforcement, our prosecutors, and our service providers see it at the ground level. So they talk to us several times a year about what are some of these new trends. Recent trends that we're seeing, drug dealers becoming pimps. We're seeing typically even gangs, but people that were historically engaged in simply the sale of drugs get someone basically hooked on a drug and then traffic them from there. They're actually oftentimes numbed by providing them with their mollies, with their heroin, fentanyl, whatever their drug of choice is, and is actually used to numb the people that are using that. Also, it drives up the debt. You can basically, that pimp can charge money for that drug. That's a distinct trend that we're seeing. We're also seeing community kids. This has been a really important trend. About 77% of our child sex trafficking victims are not in our foster care system. There's kind of a misleading narrative that goes around that says, oh, it's kids in foster care that are our primary victims. That's actually not the case. DCF has been tasked with looking at the dilemma of community kids. Kids that are still with an adult, with a caregiver, they're being exploited during the day. They may come home and sleep there at night. They're not kidnapped. That's a rare scenario. So it's our community kids that DCF is doing some quite remarkable work providing services to them. They're not in group homes. They're not in foster care. The other trend that we're seeing that I'd mentioned, children being recruited and exploited through the internet, that every city in America used to have what they called the track. This would be the street where street prostitution occurred. A pimp might be 20 feet away from where typically a woman was being prostituted. Now we're seeing that virtual. We're now seeing the internet as the place where both people are recruited for prostitution and sex trafficking, but also exploited. They're oftentimes advertised through social media and oftentimes exploited, told that, you know what, I have nude pictures of you, that will be put up on the internet. Everyone will learn what a whore you are. Much of the coercion now also happens through the internet. So internet safety is, of course, a huge issue for our children here in Florida as well. What we call domestic minor sex trafficking is the most frequent form of trafficking that we see here in Florida. Again, it's minors, someone under the age of 18 being exploited. The chilling statistic is that it's younger and younger children every year that we see being brought into this. DCF has great expertise on this, but it's children often as young as 13 to 15 who are being recruited, and many of them being groomed. They're gradually brought into sex trafficking, typically not by being kidnapped, but rather by someone that they trust. Sometimes, and the young women that I work with refer to their pimp as their boyfriend. Much of the work that we have to do getting kids out of that is actually teaching them that exploiter is not your boyfriend. He doesn't love you. He's, in fact, exploiting you. And oftentimes, it's like getting a child off drugs. They won't hear that immediately. We have some tremendous professionals here in Florida that do that very, very hard work, in a sense of deprogramming children, bringing them back up to grade level, providing therapies. Again, really important work that DCF does there. Where do kids get recruited? Schools, group homes, we do see that, shopping malls, bus stations where kids actually travel, but most often we're now seeing that it's social media. It's online communications, Kick, Instagram, Facebook, MeetMe, Twitter. I had to take part as an expert witness in a recent prosecution of a pimp, and he had to basically, as part of a plea deal, explain, how did you get access to several hundred girls in a fairly affluent Florida high school? And he said it was easy. It was Facebook. I friended one woman, young woman, who was complaining online about her mother. Within seconds, she friended me. He said, I had a fake Facebook profile. She said, I got immediate access to her friends list. And within 24 hours, I was friends with several hundred young girls in her high school. He then drew her and others into a sexting relationship, used those pornographic pictures to then coerce her and others in that high school into forced prostitution. So this is the kind of recruiting and exploitation that we're seeing oftentimes through social media. Quick look at just a couple cases for you, the kinds of trends that we're seeing. This was a local case here in Tallahassee. It was called the Henderson case, and it was a homeless young woman from the south side of Tallahassee. She met, it turns out, a local drug dealer, Deshae Henderson, also turned out to be a pimp, a sex trafficker. He met her at McDonald's on Tennessee Street. This is the FSU McDonald's where our students go, and basically befriended her. He invited her to his home a couple blocks away. It was his grandmother's home where he happened to live. He introduced her to both marijuana, but also to Molly's, the much harder street drug, got her hooked. And that within a week or two, she needed those mollies every single night. And she learned that the price for that, the price for staying at this home there, was prostitution. And what he did, he worked actually in tandem with an Uber driver, another local fella. And he and this fellow pimp, Marvin Perry, exploited both this girl and actually about six other girls for prostitution. They were delivered to men in the Tallahassee community, at times to Motel 6, to places out on Appalachian Parkway or North Monroe. It was a delivery service, and it was social media. It was Facebook Messenger that these pimps used. They didn't use a website. They used Facebook Messenger. Both of them were charged federally. The Uber dealer rolled, provided testimony. He actually was given, he got a plea deal. The pimp himself thought, you know what? I don't think our prosecutors can prove this up on me. He basically rolled the dice. He ended up getting a 25-year sentence. These young women very, very courageously testified. And by I mean courageously, this pimp had his family in the federal courthouse trying to stare down the girls as they gave testimony, and that they nonetheless testified about what he had done to them. It was a quite remarkable case. The case has gone on. Florida law now says that if you're a client of a sex trafficking operation, you're a sex trafficker. It's not just pimps. So right now, there's 170 men that are being prosecuted in both our federal and our state courts here for being sex traffickers. They were the clients. They were the men who used Facebook Messenger to arrange what they called dates with these 14-year-old girls. So very new part of Florida and federal law, sex traffickers, not just the pimp, but also clients as well. For those of us in the victim services field, the other really good news from this case, All the young women were taken to one of our 6 safe harbor shelters here in Florida. These are quite remarkable shelters where a child will go for 9 to 12 months. They'll get intensive daily therapy, counseling. Typically, they have to get brought back up to grade level. In this case, the young woman, one of the victims that I worked with quite a bit, she also was given a horse to care for. She got what we call equine therapy. It was therapeutic, and it also gave her a job. She's now actually had to leave Tallahassee because of the pimp's family being here, but she's working as a veterinarian's assistant, actually out of state. This is the kind of great work that these safe harbor shelters do. DCF licenses these, inspects them, and brings a great deal of the expertise that DCF has acquired in safe harbor shelters for minors into the new area of safe houses for adults as well. We couldn't go by and just think of what we call iconic victims, young girls. They're often victims, but so too are males and a lot of our LGBTQ individuals as well. They're also can be vulnerable. What we're learning as we look at cases around the state, many of these children, and again, they identify as LGBTQ, they're often engaged in what we call survival sex. They're trading sex on the streets for a roof over their head, a couch to sleep on, maybe a hot meal. And what we're seeing, especially for young males, they don't typically have a pimp. The trend is actually that they're introduced to prostitution by a peer. Somebody saying that, you know what, here's what you can do if you need to get by. Our young women typically have pimps. Our young male victims do not. Significantly, many of the victims, and these are ones that I've worked with that are male, they're what they call gay for pay. That they actually identify as heterosexual, but they're having to engage in gay prostitution simply as a way to get by. You can imagine the kind of therapy or the kind of support that they will need. They oftentimes, because of family rejection, don't have a family to go back to. So again, some of the great care that we do here in Florida is for males as well. Okay, very last section is to look at labor trafficking cases. We actually have more labor trafficking victims and cases than sex trafficking. That's kind of at times hidden. We don't always think about it. Here are the places where labor trafficking, forced labor, can happen. Private homes, farm worker camps, sweatshops, nursing homes, nail salons, strip clubs, hotels, and also restaurants. Oftentimes, it's migrants doing work that U.S. citizens choose not to do. But we see a ton of these cases. These are the largest number of victims, cases that occur in plain sight, and often it's a legitimate U.S. business that's oftentimes looking the other way that is responsible. The big case that we just had in Florida just this past year is called the Moreno case. And what it was, an owner of a Florida farm labor contracting group. Oftentimes, it's the subcontractor who's the trafficker in labor cases. And this was a guy, Mexican, went to Mexico, fraudulently recruited workers to come here to the United States, to come here to Florida. They came in legally. They had farm worker visas. But once they were here, those visas were taken from them. They were actually had debts put on them. You owe me $10,000 for having brought you from Mexico. And they were then worked 6 to 7 days a week, sometimes 16 hours a day, with little to no pay. Here's a picture of Mr. Moreno. You can see him there on the left-hand side with a machete. That was actually how he enforced his will. Quite brutal. For people that think, oh, labor trafficking, not as bad as sex trafficking. No, he was quite brutal. He actually didn't operate just here in Florida. He operated in Kentucky, Indiana, Georgia, North Carolina. That highway map that I showed you, he utilized that and exploited that as well. Submitted false documents to the government about work and pay. How that case recognized, a great human rights group, Coalition of Immokalee Workers, farm worker group, 2 of the people escaped from that compound. Coalition of Immokalee Workers found them, brought them to federal law enforcement. Palm Beach Sheriff's Office played a great role. Our victim advocates there. The case broke in Palm Beach County, though it extended nationwide. And there were a ton of federal charges. Again, wage and hour, as well as human trafficking cases. 17 victims actually testified, though there were over 1,000 victims that had actually been exploited. it's a reminder at times that human trafficking still hides in plain sight here in Florida. Okay? Lessons learned, law enforcement rarely discovers labor trafficking on their own. Non-governmental organizations, church groups, faith-based people are oftentimes the reporters. It oftentimes will require multiple law enforcement agencies to work together. Okay? And very last case. This was a case out in Palatka. It was African-American veterans who were exploited in this Palatka case. This was the farm, a cabbage farm, where they were exploited. And they were lured from homeless shelters. This trafficker went to homeless shelters in Orlando, Jacksonville, Tallahassee, went as far west as New Orleans. He recruited African-American men that had either an alcohol or a substance abuse addiction and told them, I have great jobs for you here in Florida. This was what was waiting for them. They were labor trafficked. You can see, you can't see it well, but there's barbed wire on top of that fence, big warning sign, no trespassing. And they were actually fed drugs and alcohol every night. Come Friday, they'd be told, should have earned $500 picking this cabbage, but you owe me $1,000 for the crack cocaine or the marijuana I provided for you. They were actually held there. Here's the picture when they were ultimately rescued, kind of gaunt, very emaciated, very sadly, many of them veterans, veterans who had come back from the first Gulf War, and this was what was waiting for them. So this is labor trafficking. It's not just foreign nationals. Many of our victims are. U.S. citizens have a lot of those vulnerabilities as well. So again, very last thing. Here are the good things that Florida has done. All human trafficking offenses are first-degree felonies. We have a very comprehensive safe harbor law. I think our DCF folks will talk to you about that today. We have a new human trafficking advocate communication privilege that you passed 2 years back. It allows people in faith-based groups, people that are advocates, that unlike an attorney, I have attorney-client privilege when I talk to a victim. Many of our advocates do not. So the advocate training that we now actually provide, the Attorney General is rolling out a 24-hour training for advocates in our faith-based communities, volunteers, so that they too can actually have that communications privilege so that things that they say cannot be discovered. And then finally, and I know we'll talk more about it today, very, very innovative adult safe house licensing, that we have safe houses for children, not for adults. There's nothing, no licensing at this point. Florida will be the first state in the country to do so. Very exciting trend and a great process that DCF and advocates have come together. They'll talk to you today about this. And the next step will be creating the actual standards to license the homes for adult survivors of sex trafficking. That's a law. As usual, as a law professor, I've said too much, but thank you very much for your attention, and thank you for the great work that all of you do here in the legislature to fight modern slavery. Thanks.
Are you available for any questions? If I think I have a couple members that have some questions for you, if you're available.
Oh, absolutely.
Before I get into members' questions, I just want to say that I'm so proud of the work we're doing in Florida. It's heart-wrenching. I've got two little ones, and so it's heart-wrenching to see Tampa lit up red over there, but I guess that is balanced with what Florida is doing and the fact that we're leading the nation in some of these policies. So thank you for educating all of us, and thank you, members, for continuing to support that legislation that's so important in our state. I'm going to recognize some members. Representative Roach, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Professor. That was, it was enlightening, but it just fires up a sense of rage and indignation for the folks that have to endure that. But thank you for the work you're doing. You know, I did have a question about the Henderson case. When you're talking about the Henderson case, you went to great lengths to explain how they were able to recruit the victims using Facebook and social media and peer connections. But one thing I'm curious about is I'm inferring from your presentation that they also contacted the Johns through Facebook Messenger. But I'm curious as how they targeted those folks, because that seems to be a very risky for a trafficker to just send a Facebook message to someone, not knowing if they're law enforcement, not knowing if they're someone who's going to report them. How do they target 170 people in the community that were purchasing these?
Part of it was word of mouth, and the Facebook messenger wasn't actually how the girls were recruited. It was how the clients, how the Johns were contacted. And the thinking was that because we're not operating a website, because we don't have an actual brothel, this is going to be the way for us to evade any kind of investigation. Now, it took actually great law enforcement to basically get subpoenas, and there's a whole set of subpoenas that our law enforcement, our prosecutors use now, their new subpoenas, to get at social media platforms. You know, we talk about dumb criminals. They had proceeded on the idea that they wouldn't be able to be made accountable because they were using private social media platforms. But that turns out to be a very, very important skill set for our law enforcement. It's a very detailed kind of subpoena, and they have to actually go to Facebook or Instagram, whatever the social media platform is, to actually get those records. But they are available, and they've been using those in court. So it's been very important, a great step by our Florida prosecutors and law enforcement to understand that.
Quick follow-up.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So I think I'm partially answered my question, partly more confused, but with the, from the traffickers' perspective, how did they target people in the community that they thought would pay them for prostitution? What kind of background did they do on someone to solicit them through Facebook Messenger to say, this looks like a good candidate that would pay for sex. Let me send them a message and see if I can put someone in an Uber and deliver them to their home.
Yeah, so it was a general Facebook post is what it would start with. And again, there's a whole code in terms of language that traffickers use. Here's a date. Here's a date that you can have with someone for X number of roses. I mean, there's a whole lexicon that our traffickers use. It led then to somebody reaching back, and then the arrangement would be made through Facebook Messenger. So it started with general social media. One of the things that General Moody has done, I represent her on our statewide human trafficking council, is to basically summon Meta to basically come here to Tallahassee and defend themselves. How have they allowed sex trafficking to be advertised on their social media platforms? By the way, they have not responded to that letter, but it points to the way that social media in general is being exploited for advertising, for recruiting, and also for coercion.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Rayner, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And Professor Conan, I don't know if you remember me from not so far long ago, but in around the 2000s, you were actually one of my professors at Florida State. And so I'm just so grateful for you and just the work that you continue to do.
And you were one of my great students,
well,
by the way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And so I learned from the best. Kind of along the lines of Representative Roach's question, because I introduced legislation last year and we'll be reintroducing it this year with Representative Saroy. So you kind of hit on something when you were talking a little bit when you answered the lack of transparency that Meta has given with regard to how they have responded to subpoenas or how they are actually targeting traffickers and also children online. What from your expertise, what would you say, maybe this is an offline conversation, what would you say are the best things that would be needed in legislation to be able to extract that information from Face, from Meta, from TikTok or Instagram or whomever, to extract the information that we need so we can protect children?
This gets into a larger national issue. There's a Google case going forward right now in the Supreme Court. The question of what kind of legal liability do third-party networks like Facebook, or it used to be Backpage, what kind of liability do they suffer? And what they claimed is that it's just like classified ads in a newspaper. You could never sue a newspaper if something got advertised in their classified ads, because newspapers would say, we're not really the ones putting that out, that it's somebody private who just pays to put an ad in. Basically, Facebook and Meta and many of our other sort of platforms have said the same thing, that, you know, you can't really sue us because we're not really responsible for what goes up. And historically within, again, what we call the Communications Decency Act, there was a carve out for basically newspapers and also arguably for electronic newspapers, things like that. So that's the battle right now nationally, that should they be able to basically deflect all blame and legal liability based on the fact that they're really just kind of the 21st century version of newspapers. For a great many of us, we don't buy that at all. And that, in fact, when they brought when they actually brought back down a number of these places like Backpage, they found out that Backpage had been editing the ads, had been basically vetting ads that were put up, so that Backpage did in fact know about the things that were going on. So the assumption is that a great many of these other platforms also know. So it's a question of legal liability. Should our victims be able to sue Facebook? Should they be able to sue? And our belief is absolutely yes, that the only way you alter company behavior is by lawsuits.
100%.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and 100% agree. You alter behavior by lawsuits and legal consequences. I guess my other question is, when we're thinking about any transparency or any information that these social media networks have given the state, whether it's Meta, what if any transparency or any information have they provided to the state or to the Trafficking Commission with regard to anything? Because I know they tell me that there's a page that people can go on in Meta and they can just click on it and they can read it and everything is fine. So like, what if anything have they provided to AG Moody or to the commission with regard to this issue?
Nothing of substance. Now AG Moody's office would be in a better position to, I think, respond to that. But my understanding is that there's been no effective response. And I think Florida is owed a response, and Florida's children in particular.
Thank you. Representative Tremont, you're recognized.
Thank you, Professor. I'd say wonderful presentation, but as Representative Roach said, the rage that fills up as a father of four, the even remote possibility of something like that being experienced is enough to send you in different mental places. I do have three questions, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking me, and you cut me off as needed.
Do two, and then I'll come back to you if there's time.
That's fine. So you know, Florida being number three, what is the draw? What is the hub that's bringing Florida? I know we have a lot of runaway areas here, and I would imagine that particular population gets swooped up pretty quickly. Can you tell me what the main draw is here in Florida?
Yeah, well, you just seized on that one. When kids run, they run to Florida, okay? We've got kids from Indiana, Minnesota. I mean, they come from all over the country. So it's our beaches. It's the perception of nightlife for our kids. It's warm weather. If you've ever lived in Indiana this time of year, you understand there's a lot of reasons to run to Florida. For teenagers, that for our teen runaways. What we're also seeing, though, is it's our agriculture industry that, you know, about half of our farm workers are not documented, so that can actually lend to trafficking. That major trafficking case that we had, the feds don't police those closely enough. The visas that our farm workers get, they're only able to work for, in a sense, the farmer or the company that petitions for them. So they don't have what we call portability. They can't walk away from a job even if they're being exploited. So part of that is a federal problem. We have a quite broken immigration system, and that leads to trafficking. A number of advocates have said that, wow, those farm workers, even if they're here legally, they can only work for that one employer. That's kind of like a legalized form of human trafficking. So we have that, but we have tourism. We have, you know, a lot of places where prostitution operates on the fringes. We have a number of businesses around Florida that actually kind of serve as magnets for trafficking. And when we say we're number three, we're actually third in the number of reports to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. So that, again, that's based on calls that are made. It's a 24/7 human trafficking hotline. Law enforcement can call, service providers or the general public, and it's based on that. We follow only California and New York in terms of the number of calls. So that's sort of seen as representative of the types of cases that we have. DCF, of course, does a quite good job at looking at child sex trafficking cases, and they provide us with some of our best statistics that we have in the state.
Okay.
You recognize for your follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Finally, and hopefully to come back for one more later. If not, I can ask you afterwards. You mentioned exploiting developmental disabilities crowd. I'm wondering, is there any indication, and I ask this because, I, you know, with experience in some of these group homes, you know, I've always taken the position that many of them are very inhumane. And given the some of the workers who were in charge of these homes, with any of your research, have you been able to trace some of these cases back to these group homes within this population?
I have to. This is just anecdotal. I haven't done the statistical research to answer that question. We have seen a number of cases out of our group homes, also kids that are in foster care. That statistic, though, and it was OPAGA that brought this to our attention a couple of years ago, is that about 80% of our victims are community kids. That being said, we do have issues at times in foster care. There are new human trafficking trainings that are required for foster care parents and attempt to get at that.
Specifically, the area of developmental disabilities, where is that coming from? Where are they targeting that population from?
Okay.
Thank you for the indulgence.
Sure. It'll often start with theft of benefits. Basically, that person with a disability getting some kind of governmental check, and it will often start with someone, a caregiver, stealing that. But it can also then mean exploiting that person. And what we're seeing is a number of cases, and this is anecdotal, but around the state where it's someone who's then being forced to do something. So we're seeing sex trafficking of children with disabilities. We're also seeing a number of labor trafficking cases. They're working in a restaurant somewhere, and they're being beaten, or oftentimes not being beaten. They just don't know that they're actually being exploited. We're hopefully the Agency for Persons with Disabilities will become a part of our statewide council. And I know DCF is reaching out to them as well, because we do understand that it's persons with these disabilities that are prime U.S. citizen victims for trafficking.
So, members, I know we could probably have this conversation all day. We have about 3 more minutes. Representative Woodson, you're recognized for as quick a question as possible. And then Rep. Maney, you're next. And we'll see what happens from there. We've got 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Professor, for your presentation. I'm an FIU graduate, so you're not my professor, but today you are my professor. You're teaching us a lot. Okay, my question to you, we know that the traffickers, they utilize our highways to transport those victims.
Right.
Is there anything that are being done by the anti-trafficking task forces or the coalition in order to capture them at the entry point?
Meaning where they start.
Where they started, as opposed to waiting, you know, for the victims to go through all the hassle that they go through. Is there anything that is being done to capture them earlier on?
There's been some great work done by the Florida Highway Patrol. They've actually intercepted a number of these cases, and where their agents, their officers understand that when you stop a car that has 11 women in it, apparently foreign nationals, none of whom speak English, and none of whom have their identity documents. Somebody sitting in the front seat has their identity documents. Our Florida Highway Patrol has actually intercepted a number of those exact kinds of cases like you just described. And because there had been trainings, they were able to pick up on the fact that something is wrong with this scenario. And they were able to then launch an investigation. So again, at times it's difficult because if you're just seeing the movement, you're not seeing the exploitation yet. And you're seeing what looks to be a red flag, but you're not seeing the actual human trafficking yet. These task forces, we have, again, about 26 of them around our state that bring together law enforcement, service providers, and prosecutors to actually share intel. That's the other great function that those task forces serve. And again, with the assistance of the Attorney General's office, we've convened them twice a year for them to share intel about what are the kinds of cases that they're seeing.
Yeah. I got to move on to Representative Vice Chair Maney. You're recognized for the last question, and then I feel confident that our professor will be happy to answer additional questions offline if members have.
And here's my contact information.
Perfect.
As well.
Thank you. Vice Chair Maney, as quick as you can.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Counselor. Would you get me, please, a contact information where people might contribute to these safe houses?
Oh, to these safe houses. Here's my contact information right up here on the screen.
Have them contact you.
Have them contact me.
Got
and
it.
I can put
Thank you.
You. These are safe houses that are undisclosed locations. They're not public knowledge, but they actually have what we call braided funding. They receive funding from the state, but also from private citizens and many of our faith-based groups. It's been one of the great efforts here in Florida. Tons of lives get changed as a result of those safe houses.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much. Another great example of private-public working together, and I love it. Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you for being here. All right, members, we are going to move on now to what was forecasted as an update from DCF. We're going to hear from Patty Medlock, the Deputy Assistant Secretary, Community Services at the Department of Children and Families. Also joining her is Stacy Afaw, the Executive Director of Selah Freedom, and Kelly Pose, the Program Director of Her Song, two organizations that are adult safe home providers. Welcome, you are recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Koster and Vice Chair Maney and Ranking Member Robinson and members of the committee for having us here today to give you an update. My name is Patty Medlock, and I serve as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Office of Community Services at the Department of Children and Families. The department would like to first thank Senate sponsor Engolia and the House sponsor Salzman for this important legislation that will ensure quality housing and services are provided for our adult survivors of human trafficking. As you just heard, this is quite a horrific crime that we all need to join together to fight. The legislation provides a pathway to partner with Florida's providers of these critical services to build out consistent statewide standards. While there are always opportunities to improve Florida's anti-trafficking efforts and keep up with the efforts of those that want to victimize our children and adults, Florida routinely is requested to participate in national conferences, provide trainings, and receive invitations for a seat at the table to participate in national efforts on human trafficking topics. I wanted to share today with the bill. I'm sorry, I'm not moving the. I apologize. I'm looking the other way. I wanted to provide here just an overview of the scope of work that we have currently at the department. This kind of goes through our current scope with accepting, investigating abuse reports, providing safety and trauma-informed services for survivors, and of course, we'll be also adding to that the development of adult safe certification along with the safe a certification for our child homes. The adult safe houses, of course, the bill that was passed, 1690, it's going to provide definitions for adult safe houses and adult survivors of human trafficking. It requires our Services and Resources Committee to submit two reports. One was in October, and we did submit that. And the second one, the final one with the recommendations, will be in December. It requires the department to create rules outlining the minimum requirements for certifying adult safe houses in December, and these safe houses will be residential facilities for adult survivors of human trafficking that will serve labor and sex trafficking. This is our timeline that we have put together since the bill passed in May of 2023. I did want to provide some background information that in November of 2022, the Services and Resources Committee of the Human Trafficking Statewide Council that's led by AG Moody, the Services Committee is led by our Secretary, Siobhan Harris, and recognized during that one of the meetings in November from a presentation that came forward from Tomas Laris, one of our providers in the community, and brought forward to the committee that we had wanted to look at quality and safe houses in the community. Wanted her committee to look at the quality, kind of look at the provider network of the state of Florida. So she kind of had a work group that started. So that work has actually been going on since November. So as that work group progressed, they began looking at the legislation and continued to do that work since May, since the bill passed. So looking forward, again, we have the report that was submitted in October. We'll get the final report in December submitted. January, we are to start rule promulgation process. We anticipate that in March, we'll have a rule adoption, and then we'll be ready to do the adult provider certification. By April of next year will be our goal. Part of the legislation was to provide us to do a survey of our providers to find out, kind of collect information on what the great work that they're doing now. This was a really important step. We wanted to make sure that we were really looking at what they're doing now. We found that there was 15 providers that reported to us that they provide housing for human trafficking survivors exclusively. One provider allowed children to live on their campus. Another 14 homes identify that they serve trafficking survivors, in their current programs. And those were providers that provided DV services, for example, domestic violence, or recovery centers with substance abuse programs. 10 providers of the 15 responded to our survey. We had 13 emergency beds that were identified and 93 long-term. One of the overarching challenges and barriers that they provided to us is access and availability of substance abuse treatment, services, and supports that they needed for their survivors. All had policies that were trauma-informed, and they coordinated with their local law enforcement and communities. None had reported to us funding from state sources. 3 reported they had some federal funding grants, and 1 was county funded. Some common themes that we found from national standards that they recommended were trauma-informed, to make sure that the policies were trauma-informed and responsive, that everything was survivor-led and informed, and ensure that safety for physical and psychological were at the forefront of any of the work that we do. We wanted to show you a map of the distribution of the adult safe homes. These are the 15 where they're located today. So you can see most are kind of in the central and south areas of the state. The group that worked, the work group, consisted of quite a few people. We had a lot of national experts to inform the group, survivors, again, providers of adult safe houses, and a lot of our sister agencies also participated in that. So the survivors, kind of first and foremost, again, we wanted to hear from them. Number 1 was safety and security. They wanted to make sure that anything that we did, any kind of standards, that was their number 1 concern. Trauma-informed and responsive care was provided. Housing options, emergency were very different needs that they had at that time of recovery compared to longer term. Individualized case management that met their needs. Access to basic needs was very important. Collaborative partnerships they wanted to see with all the different services providers. Empowerment and skill development, and then the continuum of care. Law enforcement also participated. It was very important, and they brought to the forefront building trust with the providers and the survivors, of course, and engagement is definitely much needed in this work ahead. Information sharing and communication, placements, availability, building rapid response placement protocols, and that's to really reduce ongoing trauma. Upon recovery, it was really important to law enforcement to know where placements were available so that there is not a prolonged period of time that a survivor has to wait. Excuse me. Wanted to be a part of multidisciplinary task forces and, of course, conduct joint operations as necessary. Overarching recommendations from the work group to start building that standardized were really around a lot of the things that were already happening. So I wanted to kind of say, you know, DCF, we want to make sure that everyone, that we recognize, to let you all know that we're very cognizant of and recognize, we are very interested in working and partnering and have already started this partnership to make sure that we are only looking at minimum standards. We are very understanding of the concern from the provider network of any extra or additional regulation or anything extra that would be added to and cause any kind of probably extra administrative kind of burden on them right now. We definitely are aware of that and are partnering with on that to make sure that we don't add anything extra to them. So really looking at those basic starting points of background screening, policies, training, educational needs, what do they need to support them in becoming, getting that certification over that 6 months minimum. We would like to create a longer pathway if possible. I think the legislation requires 6 months minimum. So if we could even extend that out if a provider needed that time frame. Looking at survivor input, of course, being at the forefront of helping us develop what this looks like. Highlighting specialized population and services as needed, particularly around substance abuse and mental health. That, again, came to the forefront. And being really transparent about financial practices was important as well. Protecting confidentiality also was a big key in creating this process. The certification process, again, will start in January. We'll start the initial rulemaking process to adopt these rules. Trauma-centered, survivor centers will be, the adult safe houses in operation of the date the rules adopted become effective shall have 6 months, like I shared. We are looking and trying to provide a little bit longer. We do have the availability to make sure that there's accountability in the system is built in. So if a provider is not able to provide that safe and quality services, we do have some corrective action planning and finding that's available for us. Again, these are just the basic minimum requirements that are within the legislation. So it's the safety and the security, law enforcement coordination is key, training background, making sure that all of the procedures are in place. So in conclusion, next steps is really to work with our, continue working with our work group, expanding out the partnerships that we have, developing those draft certification requirements in coordination with all of our folks, submit the final report again for December, promulgate the rule after January, begin certifying those safe houses, and then ensuring those critical connections to resources for our provider network. Again, those are going to include connecting to Hope Florida, connecting to the SAMH, our Substance Abuse and Mental Health Network. So I can pause there.
Thank you so much. And I do think before we get to questions, I think we have a couple of the safe home providers here to maybe just give us a few words on, you know, what boots on the ground looks like and what challenges maybe you guys have. That would be great. Just a few minutes, and then we'll jump into questions from the members.
Sure. Hi, I'm Kelly Posey. Thank you for having us today. And I represent HerSong, a ministry of the Tim Tebow Foundation. And I just want to thank you for caring enough to give us a call to action and to give us a voice in this issue. As we all know, there's a cost to doing nothing, but there's also a cost to acting maybe in an impulsive manner. And so I appreciate the thoughtfulness and the deliberation that we're taking and with the intentionality of this process. So I want to kind of paint a picture of what a human trafficking survivor looks like when they come to us, you know, and I think this is just like lessons that we've learned over the last decade plus of doing this work. You know, essentially, they come to us with nothing, zero resources, a crushed spirit. They're despairing, they're hopeless, and in some cases, they feel helpless to really have any agency regarding their future. And so, you know, I think it's a critical intersection for us as providers to be able to interrupt the cycle, provide some exit strategies, and really have a little bit of a prescribed pathway about how to get from here to there. And, you know, I see that process as really having some essential building blocks, you know, some, I would say, almost irreducible components to care. And, you know, some of the things that looks like really are really what Patty already mentioned in her report. You know, it's safety and it's stability. It's creating a pathway for self-sufficiency so people are able to reintegrate into their community, but also to sustain the changes that they've made. You know, we see a lot of recidivism in this population just because of the complexity of the needs and I think the overlapping cycles. So, you know, that's inherent on us to address from a comprehensive standpoint with an integrated approach, those overlapping and coinciding cycles that might pull someone back into the life, for instance, homelessness, poverty. We see a lot of addiction, as Professor Coonan mentioned, and some other things that just coincide with the mental health, the trauma resolution, et cetera. So in terms of building blocks, you know, I think our program and programs around the state that are establishing standards of care already internally are using these kinds of building blocks to build their program. But I think it's not just about what we do, because a program is, you know, you can cut and paste and really essentially build a program, but I think it's the culture of care and how we do what we do is every bit as important. And so, you know, I just encourage us to consider that as we're looking at supporting more providers to enter into this space. It's an expensive space to be in. It's high high trauma and high vicarious trauma for the staff and the people that are the caretakers. And so just considering the whole, I think, and looking at that comprehensive integrated approach is a win for all of us.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Hi. First of all, thank you guys for caring and for looking into this issue. I'm Stacey Efall from Sailor Freedom. We're based in Sarasota, Tampa Bay, Pinellas, Hillsborough area. We serve five counties, including Pasco as well. We've been established for 12 years and have served thousands of survivors. I've been in the nonprofit industry for over 23 years. I've only been with Sailor Freedom for 2 years, and I can tell you the stories that I have heard of what these people have gone through is horrific. And I really, really am happy that we have state representatives like yourself that are caring and are going to get behind the issue. I'm very grateful that we are looking at, you know, certifying safe homes, because some of the safe homes that are opening up are just not run properly. I think it's really good people who have a good heart, but they have no idea what they're getting into. I mean, again, after 23 years, I wasn't even prepared for what I'm seeing. We have already gone through accreditation process voluntarily. It was a lot to go through, but we, even after 12 years, learned things that we needed to improve. So it's a really good process to go through. I do hope that you will also consider funding. If you're going to ask other safe homes to have to improve or add staffing or add different things, please consider funding as well. One thing as a director that we are faced with right now, I have a 3-month wait. I have women waiting 3 months to get into our safe home. And we keep getting cut back on funding. VOCA's cutting back, OVC's cutting back. Everyone says they're working on human trafficking, then why is the funding getting cut back? And I am very grateful for the funding that we got from the state of Florida. Very, very grateful for that. But the federal program seemed to be cutting back. Just so you know, if there's anything you can do on that, we'd really appreciate it. It takes a lot of money to run one of these organizations properly. Right now, I do have room in our emergency shelter for 3 more beds, but I need the staffing. We're not going to throw someone into a bed. It takes wraparound 24-hour care. We provide mental health counseling, trauma therapy. We take them to the doctor. We take them to the dentist. Psychiatry is very expensive. Most of them need to get on medicine immediately, and it's an expensive thing to get to. So the cost is high, if you just remember that as we're adding things to the program. Would love for any of you to come take a tour. Would love, very open. We're very willing to help in any way that we can. We have started a consulting program where we're actually training others on how to properly run a safe home throughout the U.S. because we realize we cannot do it. We need help. We need a lot of people. We need to strengthen the people that are doing it. So again, thank you. And again, willing to help in any way that we can.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. And you answered one of our questions about a tour. If members are interested, who should they just reach out to you all directly?
Yes.
Or,
okay. Yeah, I'm speaking for Sail of Freedom, but I'm not sure about it. Yeah.
Sure. Okay, so members, if you are interested, you know, let us know and we can connect you as needed. So thank you for that offer. Representative Roach, you're recognized for a question. I guess just make sure you direct it to whoever you want to ask it to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned accreditation. What is the accrediting authority or body? Is it DCF?
We went through National Trafficking Shelter Alliance, because right now there's not a state accreditation process.
Okay.
That's what we're working on.
Does DCF, Chair?
You're recognized. I think that's what we're doing now, but go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, so we're working on a process for DCF to play a role there?
Mm-hmm. We did it voluntarily for our own. You know, we wanted to be our donors to know that we have gone through an accreditation process, but there's not a state one. So this is a national traffic. It's a shelter alliance.
Okay. And then you may have partially answered my next question, and I don't know who to direct this to, but I know that we're talking about adult safe homes, but Professor here mentioned, you know, children that were in some of these safe homes. And my question is, what role do the local CBCs play in these safe homes that children are going to? And is there a process for when a child is removed for the local CBC to get them there? How does that work?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Sure. So thank you for that question. So when a child is removed, we go through a comprehensive placement assessment process with the Child Protective Investigator starts that process. And then the CBC, the lead agency, is responsible for identifying the placement. So there is a whole MDT, multidisciplinary staffing process that occurs for any child that is found as a victim of human trafficking at that moment. They are to help us locate one of those homes. So if it's determined that a child needs and is appropriate for a safe house, they help us. Our human trafficking specialists also kind of help them find some of the homes. We only have about 6 of them. So they do play a part in that, and they also, they provide the funding. So we provide them the funding to pay for those services, and then they find the homes. Now, a lot of the children, not every child that is found to be a victim survivor of a home, of trafficking, has to go to a safe home. So I just want to clarify, there are safe foster homes that we find sometimes. Sometimes they are with a relative that we can provide services wraparound in those homes or in a different type of home. Did I answer your question?
Sure. You're recognized so,
sort
for
of,
follow-up.
When you say they provide the funding, they be in the CBC?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes. The CBC funds those homes, yes.
Okay, and I guess if I... She would indulge me with one more. Does the CBC have any sort of oversight role?
You're recognized.
Thank you. They do not. The department has oversight of those homes. We do the on-site regulation.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lopez, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for DCF. So on your slide, which you showed us, the distribution of current adult safe houses, would this be indicative of where most of the victims are, or are there places where we have victims where there are no safe homes close?
You're recognized.
I would not necessarily say that that's where all the victims are. What we have found, what they have shared with us, this is just happens to be where the provider network is. I would really probably need to go back and look at some of the data and do some comparisons. I can tell you that we do have a lot of victims in this area from our crime reports and our, you know, from the adult crime reports that we have seen. Central area and the Suncoast area do have a lot of crime being reported there. There are a lot of areas in the state that do not have providers. It's the same for our child network. We don't have providers in every single area that we would like to have them.
I will say this map definitely does sort of correlate with the hot spots on the professor's map as well. It looked to me just at first glance, but Representative Williams, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were stating that sometimes kids are actually put back in the regular homes that they're in, once they are put back in those regular homes, they are recruiting the other children that's in that home at that particular time. When they are doing the transitioning from one home or to a safe home, how do you actually decide where they actually would go?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So when we remove, are you talking about like when we remove a child or just any transition? So a multidisciplinary staffing is required at all, kind of at all, any kind of transition for the child, and particularly at removal. And at any time a child's identified as a human trafficking victim or survivor, we do a multidisciplinary staffing every time anything critical is happening. We look at what resources they need, who's caring for them. So we are looking at what is the best placement that we can possibly find for that child. Any child that needs to go to a safe group home, those safe houses are group home, we do look at, a child has to agree to go to that level of care. So that sometimes, I know you hear from a lot of, you know, survivors, they may not be ready to do that. They might not be ready. They are a more restrictive type of home. They don't allow phones sometimes. They really, it's a very protective environment to make sure that we can keep them protected. So in our homes, we do try our best to make sure that there is not recruiting going on. I know that can happen. So we try to do a lot of training. We've done the at-risk for sex trafficking homes. That's a new license that came a couple of years ago to provide additional training for our providers, for our the kids in the home, to try to do some anti-trafficking prevention techniques with them and the caregivers that are caring for them to try to get ahead of it and prevent them from becoming and recruiting. So we're trying to do everything that we can to get ahead of it and prevent it. And if we see it happening, we might have to do another intervention and try and have to move and get them to another safe location.
If it's super quick, you can do a follow-up. I've got one more question and only like 2 minutes. Super quick follow-up, you're recognized.
When you stated that these are children and they decide that they don't want to go, aren't we the adults we supposed to be making those decisions for them to try to keep the other children safe or the other victims safe?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So that's only the decision for the safe group homes. So the safe houses that Professor Coonan was talking about, those are very highly specialized homes that provide just a high level of care that a survivor of human trafficking almost has to be ready to accept at that time. So we do, those providers really have to work with that survivor. They do try to meet with them. We do kind of calls and set up or even try to go to meet to say, are you ready for this level of care? It's kind of a treatment program. So for that level of care, they do have to kind of agree to participate. If you try to, from what we hear from that provider network, if you try to force a child to go to that type of home, it could even be more disruptive for the other survivors that are there trying to engage in the treatment. It doesn't necessarily work that way with all the other placements that we do, but for that level of care, we do need to have their cooperation.
Representative Michael, you're recognized for a question. This will be our last question, and members, if you have additional questions, I'm sure everybody will be available for follow-up after the meeting.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for your presentation. My question is, when you're dealing with human trafficking, and you obviously we're going to run into the unfortunate situation of a woman that's pregnant, and when you're dealing with, we're talking about these safe homes, you have a woman, I mean, how often does that, have you all incurred or faced that situation, a mother that is pregnant, a woman, and that child is born, what happens? The child in that situation.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So the department, we haven't worked with our adult survivors yet at this level with the housing and things. We're getting ready to start doing that more. I don't know if maybe one of our providers would like to. Now, you know, in the child welfare realm, when we have mothers that are pregnant, you know, we work with them and we try everything we can. You know, if we can provide them with supports in their home to not have to remove that child from them, we would absolutely try to surround them with supports and not have to end up in a removal situation with them. If you're asking about a survivor, if they're in an adult safe home, would one of the providers like to?
Sure, yeah. You're certainly welcome if you have any more to add to that. Quickly respond, and then we do have to move on to our next presenter. But
right now at our safe home, we do not have children in it. So, but we will help them find an apartment or something, a safe place for them to stay. We would love to open a home with children and mothers to have them be able to stay together. It's just, again, for us, goes back to funding. But we do find a safe place for them to stay. We have also helped with some adoption processes for some women who have decided to put their child up for adoption and have helped that and then provided the mother with counseling afterwards. And we've had some really good success. One, the mother is still allowed to see the children as an open adoption. So there's some really good stories as far as that goes, but we really try to work with the mother and do what she desires.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for being here and for the great work that you're doing in this space. We greatly appreciate it. Next, members, we're going to hear from Wendy Scott, Staff Director of Health and Human Services at the Office of Program Policy and Analysis and Government Accountability on the 2023 Annual Report of the Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children in Florida. Ms. Scott, you are recognized.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Wendy Scott, and I am the staff director for the Health and Human Services Policy Area of OPAGA, the legislature's research office. Thank you, Chair Koster and committee members, for the opportunity to speak about our report that we did this year. This is a presentation of our annual review of commercial sexual exploitation of children in Florida.
We're going to update the presentation, but if you want to just keep going, members do have the materials.
Okay.
So keep going, but we'll have somebody come get your presentation.
Okay, great. So moving on to slide 2 in your materials, as Dr. Koonin mentioned, human trafficking is made up of two types of exploitation, sex trafficking and labor trafficking. Our study focuses on child sex trafficking, which is also known as commercial sexual exploitation, or CSE. OPAGA is directed by statute to conduct an annual study on the commercial sexual exploitation of children in Florida. This is our 9th study. Next slide, prevalence. Prevalence numbers include those youth who are verified for human trafficking in a given year. Thank you. to assess the prevalence of CSE victims or youth in Florida, OPAGA relied on the data from DCF's Florida Safe Families Network. This system contains information from the abuse hotline and from Child Protective Investigations. As was discussed previously, anybody in the public can make a call to the hotline to report allegations of CSE. There are three possible outcomes to an investigation. It's either verified, unsubstantiated, or no indication. As you can see by this chart, the number of investigations or reports to the CSE hotline have increased greatly in 2022. The number of investigations slightly increased, but not in line with the increase of number of reports to the hotline, and then the number of verified CSE victims slightly decreased in 2022. This map shows the distribution of verified CSE victims throughout the state. As you can see, the counties with the highest prevalence of verified youth victims of CSE are Broward, Palm Beach, Polk, Miami-Dade, Brevard, Escambia, and Orange. This seems like it kind of lines up with what we've been looking at today in terms of maps and heat maps where there are the most cases. These seven counties account for approximately 49% of all the verified cases in Florida. As seen in our prior reports, the majority of victims are white, female, and between the ages of 14 and 17. As Dr. Coonan stated, and what is shown here today, of the 354 verified victims, only 36% were dependent youth. For the purposes of our report, dependent youth are youth that are involved in the child welfare system. So we have a little over a third of these victims being dependent youth, and 64% are community youth. The human trafficking screening tool is used by child welfare staff, child protective investigators, and DJJ staff to help identify youth that are victims of CSE. Florida statute requires DCF to use a validated screening tool, but despite multiple efforts to validate their screening tool, it has not yet been validated. FSU's Institute of Child Welfare is working with DCF and providing feedback to help them revise the tool. DCF reported that they are revising the tool and it was to be implemented in July of this past year. Researchers will attempt to conduct another validation attempt in the spring of this year. Although Florida is not unique in not using a validated screening tool, a federal study of states showed that there were only six states out of 25 that were using one of four validated screening tools. Now I'm going to talk about placements and services that are available for CSE youth. DCF created and utilizes the Human Trafficking Placement Tool. This tool enables lead agencies or CBCs to assess all verified victims of CSE and determine the appropriate placement. OPAGA interviewed staff at seven lead agencies to get a better understanding of the process that they go through to assess youth. Most staff reported being happy with the tool's ability to identify the appropriate placement for youth, but they reported having barriers or difficulty finding appropriate placements. So the tool is helpful to identify where youth should go, but they have trouble obtaining those actual placements. DCF was unable to provide OPAGA with individual level data from the placement tool in order to conduct an analysis of the data about where children are being referred or how long they're waiting to get into a placement. The department reported being unable to provide this data because of the way it is entered, as it's entered in scanned images and not in an exportable format. This slide shows the number of youth assessed for placement in a safe house or safe foster home, the number of youth placed, and the number of CSE beds available. I believe there was some discussion about this earlier. As you can see, the number of youth assessed far exceeds the actual number of CSE beds that are available. Keep in mind that the number assessed are assessed for any type of placement. It's not just for safe foster homes or safe houses. As reported by the lead agencies and as seen through the data, there's a lack of specialized CSE placements for youth. In 2022, while there were 505 youth assessed, there were 61 individuals placed and only 63 CSE beds available. This slide shows the changes in time spent in the most common placement types for all CSE youth. There's been a decrease in the percentage of time spent in almost all placements over the past 2 years, except for the at-risk homes. The at-risk homes were implemented in 2021, and as you can see, it increased from 7% to 20% in terms of where CSE victims are spending their time, which placements. Despite at-risk homes being designed for youth who are at risk of being trafficked, the at-risk homes are the placement where CSE youth who have been verified for trafficking are spending the largest percentage of their time. This slide shows the differences in time spent in various settings between newly verified CSE youth and then re-victimized CSE youth. As mentioned previously, that at-risk homes are not intended for verified victims, we see here that newly verified victims spend more time in at-risk homes than re-victimized youth do. During 2022, re-victimized youth spent more time missing from care and in DJJ facilities than newly verified youth did. Typically, lead agencies subcontract with providers to secure housing for youth. However, few lead agencies actually have safe houses in their local catchment areas. This means that youth are regularly going outside of their home support areas in order to go to a safe house. Lead agency staff report using child-specific placement agreements and rate agreements with safe houses instead of contracts. These types of agreements do not have the same formal requirements as do contracts. Lead agencies lack a formal process for monitoring the quality of CSE service provision outside their provider catchment area for these safe houses. And instead, they assess quality through a variety of methods such as staff meetings, field visits, and exit interviews. These methods vary across lead agencies. There is not a standard format to use. Prior OPAGA reports identified issues with youth being placed in safe houses outside their catchment area. Concerns include that there are multiple case managers being assigned to safe house residents, there's delays in receiving information from the home county, and there's difficulty in meeting the youth's need at the time of placement, which can lead to destabilization and negative behaviors on part of the youth. Provider recruitment. Florida statute requires DCF regions and each lead agency to jointly assess the service capacity in their areas and establish a plan to develop the necessary capacity for this population. Department staff reported working with stakeholders such as the Statewide Council on Human Trafficking, the lead agencies, and the Children's Alliance to help recruit CSE providers. Lead agencies vary in the methods of provider engagement, and most reported difficulty finding providers to serve this population. Some of the barriers include foster parents' apprehension to serve this high-risk population, And also the requirement for safe houses to provide 24-hour awake supervision. The next section.
I'm just going to keep going. We've got about 6 minutes until the meeting's over. So keep going. I may have to cut you off at some point, but keep going.
Thank you. This next section includes data on children identified as CSC victims in our prior report. So this is somewhat of a longitudinal outcome for people who, or youth that are 1 year out and 3 years out from their CSC investigation. We examined children's outcomes in three areas: child welfare, juvenile justice, and education. For the children that we were able to track after a 1 year interval, 82% were enrolled in school, and about half of them were involved in DCF investigations, and half were also referred to DJJ. As you've heard before, this population tends to deal with trauma and other mental health issues. So we break out our data to look at victims who OPAGA was able to match a documented Baker Act examination with, compared to those youth who we did not have such a documented Baker Act record for. So this slide shows that youth that have documented Baker Act examinations continue to fare worse in nearly all outcomes compared to youth without Baker Act examinations. The next two slides highlight changes that have occurred at DCF, DJJ, and FDLE related to human trafficking. In July 2022, DCF revised standards for safe houses and at-risk homes, which resulted in less training for certain child welfare staff. The amount of required training in human trafficking was lowered from 24 hours to 12 hours, and the new regulation allows staff working with human trafficking victims 2 months from their date of hire in order to complete their human trafficking training. This results in staff working with human trafficking victims who have not completed the human trafficking training. In addition, the minimum age to be placed in a safe house was lowered from 12 years of age to 10 years of age. The Department of Juvenile Justice has implemented human trafficking training for direct care staff. They've also implemented some improvements to their human trafficking screening tool. OPAGA previously recommended that DJJ implement a human trafficking prevention curriculum or a CSE-specific service array, but DJJ has not yet implemented this. A positive note is that nearly all Florida Department law enforcement officers have completed the human trafficking training. I'm going to shift gears a little bit here.
I don't know that we have time, so okay. I'm going to have to cut you off because we don't have an extension of the meeting, and I think we could talk about it all day. I apologize for cutting you off, and members, I want to just, if you do have direct questions for Ms. Scott about the OPAGA report, please reach out. If you've got follow-up questions for DCF based on the OPAGA report, let us know. We can help coordinate and get you answers to those questions. You do have the full OPAGA report in your materials, so please feel free to review it. Again, thank you all for your continued engagement in this committee. You guys are fantastic. Thank you for being here. Sorry we ran over, but it's clearly a topic that everybody's very interested in. So thank you all for being here. Thank you for your participation. That concludes our agenda for today. And Representative Lopez moves we rise without objection. Meeting's adjourned.